Please note that this episode contains content that may be disturbing to some listeners, such as dictatorship, war, and violence. Please proceed at your own caution. This episode was filmed on September 29th, 19 days since Storm Daniel hit the city of Derna, Libya, and 8 days before the non-stop massacre of innocent civilians in occupied Palestine by Israeli occupation forces. I am your host, Asoka Hel, and this is the Libyan Diaspora, a podcast, blog, and global community with one goal, to create open dialogue for Libyans across the globe about issues facing Libyans today. Today, I am joined by Salah Eddin Garbash, someone I consider to be like family, a man who would always come to help me and my siblings out if we ever needed anything, no matter what. A man who has made a name for himself by being both a man of influence in his local government and with Libyan Americans across the country. We will be discussing his early years in the US, what it was like during Gaddafi's regime, college in America as a Libyan expat, assimilating to a new culture while trying not to erase his own, and how being a part of the diaspora has changed his perceptions of Libya and Libyans today. Hi Mustafa, thank you so much for joining me today.
My pleasure, and thank you for having me, and thank you for asking me. This is a very honorable position to be in to help people out whenever they need help.
Thank you so much. That was so kind. So why don't we start by you giving our audience a short introduction of yourself, where you're from, your family, your education, and your career.
It's really hard to say or talk about yourself, but I'll do my best. I was born in Libya. I don't want to say the year, so let's leave it like that. To be honest with you, I have had a very rough upbringing, not because of my parents, but because of the neighborhood where I live. And it was really structured to where the street taught you everything. Because frankly, your parents are working so hard to put food on the table, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Even though we don't have tables back there, we eat on the floor. But we'll fast forward a little bit until almost 1971, 1972. We have moved from the old neighborhood to a new neighborhood. And we would not believe how much drastically has changed my life. Where I started doing good in school, I was passing every grade. I have students come and ask me to help them with their homework. Sometimes they ask me if they can copy my homework and so on and so forth. Yet, with the blessing of the Lord and the 100% support of my father, God bless him, he stood by me, and when he heard me that I have a desire to go and study abroad, he did not hesitate to say yes.
And where did that desire come from?
That's a good question, because ever since I was in high school, we had this desire, my good friend and I, to come to the States. Mm-hmm. So not to mention, my father was a civilian worker at the American Air Force Base when we had the American Air Force Base in Libya. So I was really attached to almost everything that's American. Not to mention being in so civilized culture, civilized society, and the schooling over here is structured where you get for what you give in. In other words, if you work hard, if you study hard, you get rewarded. Not like somewhere else where you have to, you know, do extra things. I don't mean extra curriculum, but sometimes you do extra things, you don't get rewarded for what you do. Luckily, I moved forward in 1977, I came to the States. And I attended LSU language school for foreign students to prepare me for the culture of America, or the American culture. So the journey started in 1977. Unfortunately, the regime then in Libya, which is Gaddafi and his entourage, and the fact I didn't have a scholarship from Libya, my father was supporting me for paying for every room and board and schooling. They forbid the parents to transfer money to their kids abroad. Mm-hmm. So make the long story short, again, I started working. Even though it was illegal, I'm saying this on a mic. That was a long time ago.
Yeah.
Luckily, I got a job and I started working full time, and then I had to work part time and go to school part time. It was a struggle. That was in 79. In 1980, they enforced that order. In other words, they start threatening us, students, if we don't go back, they will harass our family. So I said to myself, between myself and I, why should I put my family in this predicament where, you know, they will be interrogated, questioned because of me? So I bagged my bags and sold my car and I went home in 1980. Wouldn't you know, while I was there, they gave me a scholarship and sent me back. And that's really where really the good journey started. So I came back to the same college, the same town, and with the help of the Lord and, you know, with the good luck, I guess, too, with the blessing of the parents, I got my first degree in 1983 and a second degree in 1984. The two of them are in business. And I got a job right away with a good reputable company in the United States to be a district manager trainee for one of their areas in Southwest Louisiana. But it did not really mature like was, or did not really get where I wanted to be. So in 1987, I moved to Florida. My wife and I had a little child then, 6 months old. We moved to Florida with no jobs lined up. I mean, we're just gonna go in blank, so to speak. But again, I was being thankful and grateful. Things turned for the better. I moved forward a little bit where I just retired from Hillsborough County government in 2017. After 27 years of service with Hillsborough County, my last position I had in the budget in the fiscal area, where I was promoted to be fiscal operation manager for our communication department in Hillsborough County.
That was very insightful. Thank you. So, Amusa, can you tell us more about your life with your father working at a U.S. military base in Libya, how that really affected your perception, of America? And because, like, obviously a lot of kids, I think, in my opinion, have, like, watched a lot of U.S. shows, like Hollywood shows. Has it, like, was it different, I guess, in a way, in a sense?
As a matter of fact, yes. It's a good question because somehow, I think I mentioned that before to other people, my father was lucky enough to have his bosses let him use the shopping center on the base. So the things that we get, especially when you're a child and your father brings certain things from the base, which is American-made, American product, you know, you feel like you're tickled, you know, a little bit, because you show off in front of other kids your age or whatever. So imagine if you have your TV is American-made from the base, if you have your washing machine, and we had a washing machine from the base, and the radio from the base. So the thing is that now we look at it as being small things, but then in the 60s, those are big things.
Yeah.
Because you gotta imagine a lot of people did not have the luxury to make a lot of money. But I guess my father and his, with the Lord's blessing, he got this job with American. He was paid more than what the average citizen was making. And imagine in our neighborhood, I'm talking about the entire neighborhood, he was one of the few, when I say one of the few, I mean less than 1% who owned a car.
Yeah.
So in 1962, my father bought his first car, and I remember it was cash too. I mean, that's, it was really thrilling to have that. Imagine you are riding with your father in your car and looking through the window and showing off to everybody. But this is the quality of life I had with my father. He spoiled me, but yet he protected me, yet he loved me. So he always supported me. He's like the spine. For me, I mean, my back spine, to help me succeed.
So was your school an English school? Because I know now we have, in Libya, we have like American schools. Were you in an American school?
In Libya, no. No, I wasn't. I was in a public school. I mean, yes, there's other kids, I mean, I think privileged enough to go to American schools.
And yeah.
As a matter of fact, if you want to know the name of it, it's called Tripoli College. And it's really very, very famous and very well known too. And again, above and beyond that, I feel really lucky. I feel humble. I feel sometimes I need to return the favor to my siblings and my kids, and you know, to show them what my father had done for me, I would like to do for them.
That's so sweet.
Well, thank you.
So let's talk a bit more about Gaddafi's regime. What was like your first memory you believe you've had of him in power?
Frankly, not just me, I would say on behalf of the rest of the Libyan people. When he went to the town of Zawara, which is a small town on the border of Tunisia, and he made a speech and he called the 5 points. Frankly, when I heard them, I didn't understand anything what he was saying. But of course, later to the TV and political analysts, whatever, he made or he put the foundation to change Libya to almost like Russia then.
You know,
being aggressive, being undemocratic, being lawless, without law. And what made matters worse, and I remember one of those points, and that he insisted and he made it as a rule, if you live in a house, that's your house. So imagine if you are renting a house from somebody, you don't have to pay a rent anymore. If you drive a truck for somebody, that's your truck from now on. So you don't owe anybody any money. And that's how he did it. And this is very, it's almost what we say in English, highway robbery. If it's a bigger degree or higher degree than highway robbery.
Yeah.
A lot of people I know, frankly, personally, have had heart attack because imagine when somebody takes your possession away from you, something that you cherished, something that you worked real hard to accomplish, yet somebody will take it from you in a New York second, like they say. This is when I really start thinking and had my mind definitely not to stay over there anymore.
And how old were you at this time?
21.
So was this like the final decision saying, yes, I want to leave this country because especially of his regime and what he's been doing to the people I know and I care about?
Actually, it was really half and half. I mean, it was because of the regime, because of the atmosphere, I mean, in general, you know what I mean? But the other half was really seeking the education. And I was really geared up to, once I graduate, I want to go back and serve my country.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, by the time I graduated, things got a lot worse. Sanctions. So in the 80s, I think in the early 90s were the worst years for any Libyan.
Yeah.
I mean, probably your mom or somebody, or if you heard about it, those are the worst years. Thank God I didn't go back. And that's when I got married and I got established and I, you know, started looking after myself because, you know, for how long you want to, I'm going to branch us another, to collectively, most of the Libyans who were here in the United States, Canada, and Europe, collectively, we created an opposition. So they start, you know, fighting Gaddafi from abroad.
Yeah.
Meaning, not necessarily fighting with weapon, but newspapers, magazines, lectures, radios, things like that.
Yeah.
So, to be an eye opener for those who are in Libya, they are living in hell. They need to wake up, they need to have an uprising, they need to correct the action.
Especially for me, because I remember when I was younger, I believe it was like 27, no, not 27, a little, and it was in the early 2000s. I remember me, my brother, and my sister were protesting, and no one fully understood why. Because obviously we understood because we were Libyans, but when people saw this on the street, they were so confused because no one at that time had heard of what was going on in Libya. No one, and especially in the media, and just in the whole country, and really just understood and cared about us.
Because it really is not a hot topic. I mean, when you think about it, the media is what? It's a company. They're looking after the bottom line, profit, you know? But when they mention Libya, no one has interest in hearing about it, especially the grievance, the problems, this and that. They want something hot, they want something spicy, they want something can hold them watching TV longer so they can have commercials and this and that. That's how they get paid.
Yeah.
But Libya, because of Gaddafi, now when you say, I'm from Libya, how many times have you been asked? They say, Gaddafi, When you say from Libya? No, yeah. Gaddafi.
I remember specifically, my mother said she was from Libya once, and someone said, oh, Gaddafi, I love him. He did so well for Africa. And we were just standing there in complete shock, because that's such a weird thing. You would not say to someone who escaped North Korea, wow, I love Kim Jong-un. No. So why would you say that to us?
Well, this is sometimes I claim ownership. This is also like my team. If you draw a circle,
yeah,
doesn't matter what size of a circle.
Mm-hmm.
If you are inside that circle, you will never be able to see it all.
Yeah.
But if you step out of the circle, you'll be able to see it.
Mm-hmm.
Those people never lived in Libya to see exactly what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, he extended the monetary help to Africa. He deprived his own people,
mm-hmm.
but yet he gave millions and millions to Africa. He gave millions and millions to the Ireland people who are fighting what they call freedom in Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he supported what, I'm going to quote unquote, you know, terrorists to help, you know, do well for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
He gave a lot of money. Those people can see that from abroad. They don't see it from inside. Yet we have people who are lacking education, lacking health, lacking transportation, infrastructure in general is so bad. I mean, you name it. Anyhow, so this lady, who the person who said they love him, because from what they saw on their part, you see, that's why.
Yeah. So do you think while you were sitting here in America that you really were at a conflict, I guess, per se, that your own culture and American culture were kind of against each other, especially because you were from a dictatorship. You didn't have exactly the same life, but U.S. you did, you know, quite a bit about America when you first came, but did it really, like, your relationships with people, was it very hard?
You know, you put me in a position that's very difficult because, yes, you never know whether to sympathize with them or empathize with them or speak ill about the country and the regime,
mm-hmm.
or because no matter what, I mean, you can't take me out of Libya, but you cannot take Libya out of me. As a matter of fact, on several occasions and a few times, I mean, I cannot deny, not just me, other who are new friends, acquaintances, have encountered some kind of, I don't want to say racist or bothering, or because, as you know, we don't want to dwell on that, the South is very known for being racist,
yeah.
and prejudiced. Especially we have the brown skin and
mm-hmm.
the kinky hair, what have you. They know, they think, or when they ask you where you're from, you say from Africa, they think you are from South Africa, from Central Africa.
Mm-hmm.
They ask about the lions and the elephants and things like that. I have the opportunity one time chit-chatting with a family from the country in,
yeah.
Louisiana, and one of them, believe it or not, she asked me the question, quote unquote, do you have a bathrooms there? So because they think we live in a, you know, out in the desert where
mm-hmm.
they have no running water, and whenever somebody uses the bathroom, they go and use the outhouse or something like that.
Yeah.
But that's how closed-minded they are. And that would bring us to a point. There is a little bit differentiation between those who are educated
mm-hmm.
and those who are not. And I'll give you another example. I'm always full of examples.
I
remember vividly my landlord, who was a vice president of a construction company, by the way, he's the one who gave me the job when I was working there. He said, Salah, for a while, and he was being serious. He said, Salah, for a while, I thought Louisiana was the whole world. He didn't think of any other places,
yeah.
okay? They don't. Some of them got to the point we don't even know where the Canada is, or what country borders America from the north. They don't care, you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
They live day by day, and that's mostly, I don't want to say all of them, but in general, in the South. And that's something we had to not only encounter, but re-educate those people nicely,
mm-hmm.
not to be aggressive or not to say you are stupid or you're dumb. No. So we have to go back few years ago. So it started like, if you remember what happened such and such a year, if they say yes, you can build on that. You see,
yeah.
what I'm saying? At least you got their attention at the time. So what's so good about this country, sometimes 9 out of 10 everybody leaves you alone.
Mm-hmm.
You do your thing, I do my thing. As long as you respect yourself, I respect myself. You give me my personal space, I'll give you your personal space. And that's what's so good about it. Unfortunately, you don't see that somewhere else, like the paradise we have here. And mm-hmm. that's why we get attached to stay in this country more ever than being, why not Canada? Why not Europe? You know, why not other Arab country? But that varies from one person to another, which way they feel comfortable. What people say, do you sleep on your right side or do you sleep on your left side? Which one is comfortable for you? You know, you sleep on it. The one is comfortable. So my ambition and my desire, and I accomplished that and I fulfilled that, to come to the States and go to school in the States. And by the way, I give you the icing on the cake. I'm the only, or I should say, I'm the first person in my family, both sides, from my father's side and mother, to go to college and graduate from college. That's really, which is a privilege, you know?
Yeah.
Not because others are not educated, no, because there were not enough schools and colleges and universities to fulfill their desire, to fulfill their demand, source.
Yeah, so you would say the cultural differences were what allowed you to feel more at home here in America than what instead of Libya?
Absolutely, yes, absolutely. And the fact that, I'll give you another example, one of the reasons I think we mentioned that before, my dad never finished schooling because what? He had to stop going to school to help his mom and dad bring food on the table.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how bad it was. Not to mention the time period when they were growing up, the country was colonized by Italy.
Mm-hmm.
So when you live under the colonization of a foreign country, I mean, you are probably second or third citizen. You know, you don't get anything their kids get. Not to mention, I use that a lot, not to mention the fact that hardly any schools, I mean, you're lucky if you are from a rich family, well-known family, that you will get to high school.
Yeah.
And there's only one high school in the entire city, Tripoli. So move forward, there's only one college, one university in Libya, which is the University of Libya then. They changed the name of it to Gaddafi's regime. But now, I mean, I cannot tell you how many schools are everywhere, how many colleges and universities.
Yeah.
Because not only government universities, now they copycat. They have private universities where you pay and you get your degree. And as long as you have a degree, they don't care if you pay it or not. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And that's how it is over there now.
Yeah. So you would say money has played a factor in how Libya has progressed both educationally and culturally?
You hit the nail on the head, seriously, Uswa, because as of 1959, Libya was poor, was living on the grants and the handouts from the international banking system from other countries, to the point where if you do a little research, why there was an American Air Force base in Tripoli, because they leased the land to America so they can pay for that.
Mm-hmm.
And they leased another base in the east for the English, and they leased another base in the south to the French. So collectively they are paying the money to occupy a piece of property on Libya because there was no resources, there was nothing. I mean, to substantiate, to fulfill the need of everybody. Mind you, I'm gonna put a little asterisk here, so to speak again. we were a very small population. I'm talking about when I was growing up, we were only 2 million people.
Yeah.
But fast forward in 1960, 61, 62, when the oil was discovered and they started producing, the equation became reversed. Now, remember we said, well, we are a small population and the income very high. So a lot of people got rich quick if they used their head. And some people they did see the light at the end of the tunnel, meaning they start pursuing schools, colleges, university. They became educated. They were able to send their kids abroad. I mean, I'm talking about, we were one time, I think statistically, in the late 70s, if I'm not mistaken, according to the Libyan embassy in Washington, D.C., over 5,500 Libyan students in the United States.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
So at your time in Libya, were there quite a few Libyan students with you?
Yes. That's a good question again. Wow, you are full of questions. First of all, I mean, no matter what, I think the seven of us resided in Lafayette, Louisiana, didn't know each other from Libya. We knew each other here. But I think what brings us together, our ties to our country. So we always collectively did things together. Sometimes we go out on a picnic with other families from another, from an adjacent town, and there is a celebration of somebody's getting married or somebody got a baby, this and that. But no matter what, we got together as if we knew each other for so long.
So do you think the Libyan diaspora in America had grown into, let's say, a mini Libya for you guys? And was it really something that helped you guys go forward into your lives? And did it like last until, I would say, your age now?
Beautifully said. Yes, it's almost like Libya in exile, you know, abroad, you know. So yes, we celebrated together. We celebrated the same way together. There were, until recently, I would say, we were one nation, nothing east, west, south, you know. Mm-hmm. We're Libyan, it doesn't matter from Benghazi, Tripoli, or from Sabha. And we were not only celebrating, but encouraging one another, supporting one another, stand by one another. And believe me, they even had a lot of demonstrations mm-hmm. against Gaddafi. They went to his embassy in Washington, D.C. Mm. They went to the office of the UN in New York, and they demonstrated there. So, and not they were not covering their faces. They were in the open. They were demonstrating against Gaddafi.
What did your family back home, if you've told them about it during that time, what your community was like? Were they happy for you? Were they a little confused? What were they like?
I think more confused than anything else, because they cannot see the entire, they cannot see the big picture.
Yeah.
Yes, I was involved in the, like I was saying a while ago, with the motion of having an opposition, but I'm not one of the leaders of the opposition. I mean, just a participant. But Gaddafi's regime did not care if you're a participant or a leader. Your name is on the list. Mm-hmm. Some, of course, unfortunately, with a little bit of a bad luck, when they went home, they got arrested and they got thrown in jail. Literally, I knew some of them. As a matter of fact, my neighbor, I know him personally, I grew up with him, he was jailed for 17 years. Out of the minute he graduated, he went back to help his family, okay? Instead, he was put in jail for 17 years.
So these members of the diaspora who have been living in America for quite a bit have realized it's my time, I can go home and help and make a change. Yet, when Gaddafi has noticed this, that they are bringing their views and their cultural experiences.
He got scared.
Yeah.
He got, bottom line, he got scared. And literally, he started hanging some of them. He mm-hmm. started executing some of them. Unfortunately, I know a couple of them personally. One of them was my neighbor in Lafayette, one of the nicest guys you can think of. I'm not sure because he's dead now, but I'm saying I know him personally. Educationally, morals, you name it. And he graduated with a double degree, mm-hmm. computer engineering. When he went to Libya, he was hanged.
Allah rahmah.
Yes.
So did this like change your community? Did it make you guys stronger or did it make you guys weaker, would you say?
Here?
Yeah.
Stronger, definitely, mm-hmm. yes. We are very defined.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in a broader, I would say, bigger picture, it opens the eyes for others to see what the community doing in the United mm-hmm. States, and they were copying us. Because I think, not to forget, this is in the Constitution, we have the freedom of speech over here. Some others don't have that luxury mm-hmm. or the freedom of speech at all, see? So they have to to watch their what they're doing, how they do it, where they go, and what have you, you know. So, you know, as long as you get a permit, and like you mentioned a while ago about the demonstrations, you get a permit from the local locality, and you can do it. As long as you don't touch somebody or hurt somebody, you're okay.
Did your community in America, the Libyan diaspora in America, were they connecting with other parts, forms of the diaspora in like Europe or in other countries?
Definitely, yes. The higher-ups, yes.
Mm-hmm.
They are very, very connected because some of them, they were once upon a time either ambassadors under the Gaddafi regime, then repelled. You know, one of them was the foreign minister, as a matter of fact, Mr. Rashid Al-Kikhia, if you remember him. Who else? I would say some of his, from the beginning, were his supporters, Gaddafi's supporters, but they turned against him when they found out the true person that he was.
So you would say, from little kids growing up in Libya, seeing little movies about America and all of that, and coming to America, and then forming a community, this helped really ignite the movement for the Libyan Revolution, would you say?
Part of it.
Yeah.
Yes, it has. Definitely, no doubt. But don't forget, even after, I would say, after 2002, 2004, when his kids, I'm talking Gaddafi's kids, grew up or grown, and they came back to Libya because they were educated abroad as well.
Mm-hmm.
They opened their eyes, where? In Europe. And they came home and they want to implement what they already witnessed abroad.
Mm-hmm.
And they convinced their father to ease off. In other words, don't be an ass, in other words. So for a while, we were, as a young kid myself, I was afraid to go visit Libya.
Yeah.
But then after 2020, after 2000, really the doors opened up.
Mm-hmm.
Even those who were part of the opposition had the luxury to go back and visit Libya. So now the door is open.
Yeah.
But the regime is the same.
Mm-hmm.
But the conditions of what we used to hear about it is not the same anymore. His kids ease off the regime a little bit. They wanna be like another town in Europe. You know, when somebody comes home, and they started. I can't deny that. I mean, you gotta give them this much. They, especially his oldest son, who was educated in the UK, he tried even bring and those give them. Let me rephrase that. Those who are heavily involved in the opposition, give them the freedom to come home with no repercussion.
So the diaspora has truly, the diaspora led to true change in Libya and led to a different viewpoint of certain members of his regime, you would say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And from good to better to best. And as a matter of fact, if you put all this together like a chain, one link at a time, that's what led to Intifada or the uprising in 2011. Because imagine if you have so many people pushing you from every direction, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Collectively, they managed to educate those local back home. What you are living in is not exactly a life that you're supposed to have. We are in a perfect country. We deserve a better regime. And that's why, after whatever happened in Tunisia, I remember the guy burned himself as the beginning of the Intifada and moved over, jumped over to Egypt because of Facebook, then to Libya, then to Syria. And I think the time frame that when it happened, the way it happens very quick.
Yeah.
Because in a comparison, because unfortunately, Syria is still struggling right now because they couldn't shake him off.
So the Arab Spring really affected Libya's revolution and its changes in society and its culture.
Absolutely, yes, yes, definitely. Unfortunately, and nobody can see then, because nobody has the crystal ball to see, things didn't go well as expected.
Yeah.
Which is in any undemocratic society, when you put someone who's not qualified to be in that position, you're not going to get the outcome that you are looking for. So now we're stuck with some people are after one thing, how to get rich, how to get take advantage of the system, how to become known through the media because it, so everybody can talk about you. You know?
So do you think the revolution truly caused Libya to have its civil war and to have this idea that money it should be above all of our moralities no matter what?
I think I would agree with that, yes. You know why? Because those people felt like they need the revenge for what they have suffered.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because they lived there the most. And I think if you remember a brief discussion we had, they resented anyone who would come to Libya, try to help Libya with dual citizenship. See?
The double shafra.
You remember that? So those with double shafra went over there immediately or from the beginning of 2011 until 2012 and 13. Things got messed up in 2014 when they had the war. And the squeeze of vice, you know what a vice is? The one you put together so you can clamp on a tool. It's a tool itself. So they were squeezed out. When those people got out of the country, the theater was open for those who are want just have a grab and go.
So this idea that money is above morality, how do you think it's affected the everyday citizens of Libya, such as, let's say, your friends and their families and all that?
Well, I have a very short answer for that, because it seems like nothing has changed in the last 12 years. Nothing.
Yeah.
There is no infrastructure. Unfortunately, it's so sad to say, you probably cannot record my facial expression, went from bad to worse.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the oil never stopped being produced and exported.
Yeah.
The money's still coming in, but what to do with the money, nobody knows. To the point where I think I already explained to you, we are Libya, the only country that I know of has two governments,
mm-hmm.
one in the east, one in the west. But to me, that cannot be resolved easily. It was really hard to be resolved because it's going to take time to resolve. Not to mention the general, and I think I already discussed that with you at the beginning, those kids, those were 3 or 4 years old in 2011.
Mm-hmm.
How old are you right now? How old are they now? About 18, 19?
Yeah, I'm 17. Brother is 21 and my sister is 20.
But imagine those who are in Libya just a few years before 2011,
mm-hmm.
and now they are young men, ambitious,
yeah.
looking forward to build their own lives, and looking forward to go to colleges, but they can't,
mm-hmm.
because it's really hurting them so bad. One of them, which is from my perspective, being an accountant, the inflation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the buying power has diminished over there. To be able to make enough money to open a house for yourself and you know get married and have kids, if you don't have the help of your parents, it's not going to happen. Not to mention, everybody's struggling for a job. From what I hear, if I'm not mistaken, the last statistic, if they have any statistic over there,
mm-hmm.
50% unemployment within the gap or the age between 20 and 40. 50% unemployment.
So do you think this has led to this idea in Libya now, bringing in clothes and like products from abroad and selling them in Libya before a substantially higher price than it should be sold? Do you think it's really affected how Libyans don't want to be Libyan anymore, to be honest?
Well, that gives you a good example. That's why you probably already heard about the migration of Africans to Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Via the Mediterranean.
Yeah.
Libyans are doing it right now. And that's a
good
example.
Yeah, I've seen it. They're very racist towards them. It's so truly, it's just sad and horrible.
But the point I'm trying to tell you or make it from here, you got to remember, he has nothing to lose.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he lost everything. He has no future in Libya. Might as well get on a boat and go to Europe.
Yeah.
What's going to happen? If he dies on his way to Europe, he's dead already. He's not having a good time in Libya. So what the heck?
Yeah. I think I've seen a documentary about this before. It's about these group of, it's a militia in Libya who has control of an oil rig. And they catch migrants fleeing Libya to go to Italy. And they're just it's just inhuman. It's not right the mm-hmm. way they're treating them yes, and all that. Yes. Do you think it's really affected and engraved in them this idea as a society that we have to protect ourselves and we should never allow anyone else to have more than we have?
That's true too. But what's so sad in a smaller scale, what the documentary mentioned, imagine those Africans who come in a segments. They don't travel from point A to point B, by mm-hmm. the way. No, they take their time. They work in this village or this town to make some money, so they move on until they get to the coast. But the militia you mentioned, they captured them and they tortured them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've seen maybe not the same documentary you've seen
yeah.
where they take their money, they take their cell phones, and you give them the ultimatum. You want to go out, you have to do this, and this. You have to work for this. Got to the point where I think part of the documentary were selling them as slaves.
Yeah.
Literally. I've seen that.
Mm-hmm.
So imagine what kind of life is that when you see yourself in a position on a predicament like that. You say, heck, I would do anything just to get the hell out of there.
Yeah. It truly is so sad.
And what's another point when you mentioned militia, this is one of the biggest issues that they are having right now mm-hmm. in Libya, because they are uncontrollable
yeah.
and they have the possession of the weapon.
Mm-hmm.
And from time to time you hear about a group of a militia blocking a four corners of a highway or a intersection or whatever, checking everybody's IDs, but who can tell them no?
Mm-hmm.
Nobody. I mean, they do whatever they please. If they strip whatever you have, money, cell phone, purse, personal belongings, are you going to say no? If you say no, probably you kill you.
Yeah.
That's how life, a human life, became so insignificant in there.
And I would say the way they're getting money would be very confusing to others because of the weapons embargo that the UN has placed on them. And people might be really, truly wondering, where are they getting these weapons?
It was already there,
yeah.
unfortunately, from leftover from Gaddafi's regime.
Mm-hmm.
But then, I think in the mid-teens, I'm talking about like 2014, 2015, you heard the Khalifa Haftar having been one of those Gaddafi's generals that he sent to live in exile, but he came back to Libya
mm-hmm.
and he created himself as the army leader.
I mean, yeah.
And he bought more weapon from Russia. He bought more weapon from Europe, I don't know. And from, of course, the black market, let's mm-hmm. fix it, you know. And he gave it out to the militia to do what? To protect him.
Mm-hmm.
And to protect the inner circle. And that's what it is. The average Joe, the average citizen, like if you and I live in Libya, have no power to go against yeah. them.
And I guess this has led especially to this issue with people, members of militia stealing houses, because I've heard from people that I know that their family has lost their house because they will simply bulldoze their gate and then steal it from them.
Yes, yes, yes. And sometimes it's just a vicious way to
mm-hmm.
do it. Not to do it to benefit from it. I mean, if you want to just bulldoze the gate and go in and live in it, that's more power to you. But to go in and really ransack everything
yeah.
and steal whatever valuable that you have left. Sometimes, you know, people don't believe in banking, so they leave their money at home.
Mm-hmm.
So you go back and you find yourself, oh God, I lost everything. How you feel?
Yeah.
Some people had a heart attack, you know. Some people have very long-term depression because of that. You know? But it has happened. Because of what? They have the power. They have the weapon. The militia had it. Yeah.
So, for like present-day Libya, especially if you've heard of Derna, La Rahamhum, do you think that, because I've heard that quite a few Libyans are going to Derna, they're helping out their own citizens. Do you think this will enact a different change for Libyans and its society and culture?
That's the prayer everybody's praying right now,
mm-hmm.
because they said a town is dead, but the country was born.
Yeah.
You know, because whatever animosity they had, east against west against east, has been gone.
Yeah.
Because the citizens themselves from the east saw firsthand A few years ago, they were in Libya fighting in Tripoli, killing people in Tripoli. Now the Tripolitanians in the east, helping them, bringing them food, trying to help them rescue live people, trying to rebuild their town. Mm-hmm. So to them, that is big, bigger than what you can describe or imagine.
In my opinion, I believe that this hurricane and the loss of life, I think it's reignited the Libyan diaspora once again, because especially during your time, you guys were fighting the regime. Our time, our like members of my community, we don't talk about Libya as much as we should be. We don't enact change. We don't try to help our other Libyans. But I've heard, like, especially like Libya in the UK has been helping, and they have been fighting and trying to protect the other Libyans in Libya. Do you think this will create another community that will truly enact another type of, not revolution like a war, but revolution of culture?
Well, I'm waiting for to finish what you were saying, because that will bring us back to 2011, when we were all together from the US, from Europe, from Canada. I mean, some people sold their homes, literally, to buy ambulances to send them over there, to buy medical equipment to send it over there, to send cash to help people fight Gaddafi and his regime, because the fighting lasted for about 6 months over there, if you recall, until he was shot or killed, whatever the case may be. But whatever brought us together in 2011 brought us together again in 2023, which is different in this case.
So what are your final thoughts on what's been happening in Libya recently and what has happened in the past? What do you think, moving forward, Libyans should do and how they should help each other out?
Uswa, you are bringing something else in me now. Sad to say, because the Libyan demeanor of an average person over there is really hard to understand, even for the psychiatrist. Mm-hmm. So when you put something in perspective to have A, B, C, D, 1, 2, 3 to be followed, they don't follow them over there. They do whatever they please. So probably the most negative thing I would say or have said before, some of them, they will tell you in your face, yes, 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 we'll do. But once you leave, they do whatever they please. They do not follow any specific plan. And that's why, unfortunately, I mean, now, remember, I lived until I was 21 in Libya, then I came over here. When I went to visit, which is last year, and I'm going again next week, I have seen some places hasn't changed at all. I mean, the some of the roads still dirt, mm-hmm. no asphalt, no concrete, no bridges. I mean, come on, you are in power, or at least you have the resources to build yourself a decent country, and you're not doing it, there's something wrong right there.
So you would say for Libya to become what it truly can be and it deserves to be, Libyans first have to change, their mindsets have to change.
Underline mindset. That if it does not change, Libya is not going to change. And funny you said that, because back in 2011, people are so happy, they're so excited that Libya is going to change. And I told them, and I'm being serious, and I said it then, don't get excited. It's going to take generations, not one, to change. Because whatever Gaddafi has created and introduced to our lives to live with, and now the new generation that lived through the Intifada, it's going to be hard to correct that. It's not easy. And I'm being truthful. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. It's going to be brutal.
So if it was to change and Libyans, their whole mindsets would change, what would be your dream for Libya?
Personally, I mean, I'm not going to copycat, but I would see at least the average person will have what they need, mm-hmm. not what they want, what they need conveniently,
yeah,
accessible, cheap, affordable. I mean, things like that. So I'm not going to say we're going to be like Dubai or we're going to be like Paris or London or New York. No. I mean, that takes a lot of major steps to be that way. But at least give the citizen what they deserve. I mean, when I describe to my sibling or my family or my relative that, I ordered something on Amazon And when I came home, it was on my doorstep. They look at you again, what do you mean? Nobody took it? No, nobody took it. I mean, nobody steals something that's not theirs unless you're in a bad neighborhood. I mean, in a rough neighborhood, that probably happened. But no, there is a trust. Simple things that you and I live in this country, take it for granted. Over there, they look at you astonished. What the hell are you talking about? Because they cannot comprehend the fact that I can transfer money to you, or you can transfer money to me by clicking a few clicks on your phone.
Yeah.
Right? They don't do that. Then I'll give you an example, which is, I'm full of examples today. My brother and I were in the car, and he said he needs to go to the bank to get some money. I said, okay, let's go. So he takes me to the busiest section of town, which is Medan Shuhadat. You know, remember now, it's very notorious, the center of Tripoli. I said, why did you come over here? Why didn't you go to the branch that we have next door? He says, no. Where you open your account at the bank, that's where you get your money.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot go to another sister branch bank to get your money. They don't talk to each other. I said, that's kind of bizarre. It's the same bank, isn't it? The same accounting system, isn't it? He says, yeah. But they will not let you withdraw from your own account unless you go to the source where you open your account.
Yeah. So what you want for Libya would be more community building, more trust with each other, and truly just
the trust thing is there right now. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's something in our DNA. Seriously, we do trust each other, but it's gonna be more enhancement to it. Yes, a lot of people got deprived from a lot of things. They were, remember, in the old days, they were rich. They had a lot of money, small population, so there is a lot of surplus. Now it's the opposite. There's a lot of people, it's about 6 or 7 million people, and not enough income.
Mm-hmm.
So the equation has reversed.
Yeah. So what would be your final feelings after going through this discussion? What has it changed in you, do you think?
I hate to say nothing, because to be honest with you, the only thing I can do is sympathize with them, empathize, you know? And I try to ease the pain by providing them of whatever I can, accessibility to get them what they want, not what they need, not what they want. You know what I mean? And it's not easy that I'm again grateful and thankful for the God's blessing on me, that I have what I have. I have my kids; they have what they have. Things like, and we have the luxury to be able to travel, and to them is not easy.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, like I said, the buying power has diminished, because, and I give you the equation for your own information. When I came to the States in 77, I can go to the bank and buy $3 with £1, Libyan pound, jni.
Mm-hmm.
You go to jni, huh? Mm-hmm. You know jni?
Dinar.
Yeah. Now, you have to have 5 dinars for every dollar.
Yeah.
I mean, reversed. And it was even worse. It was almost got to the point to 9.5 dinar to a dollar. So imagine you are an entrepreneur and you want to buy something to sell in Libya. But when you buy it from other countries, you are paying with a dollar. So when you want to pay with a dollar, you have to buy a dollar, and you have to buy a dollar expensively, right? So when you bring the goods to Libya to sell, how are you going to sell it? With profit or losses?
With quite a few losses.
And that's the dilemma we live in.
Yeah.
Thank you, sweetie.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been quite an informative discussion. What would you like to say to our audience? What do you want them to take away from this?
From being so old and older than you, we have to be patient. The first thing, we have to be patient. And things will change. Things will change for the better eventually. Because I think I've said that before, not to you, but somebody else, the Roman Empire did not last, okay? The Turkish Empire did not last. So history will repeat itself and will succeed, will be better. Ciao.
I am your host, Osok Kahel, and this has been episode 1 of the Libyan Diaspora. Thank you so much for joining us on this journey through time and discussing culture, politics, and our dreams for Libya's future. Feel free to subscribe to Libyan Diaspora anywhere you listen to podcasts and follow us on Instagram at the Libyan Diaspora. Don't forget, be proud, be you, be Libyan.